Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik. I am here today with Craig Hudson. He is the author of From Rail Yards to High Rises, A History of Chicago's Illinois Center, the New East Side, and Lakeshore East. Craig has worked in research and development, academia, and industry, and is fascinated with the history of Chicago's lakefront. Welcome, Craig.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's great to have you. This is an area that, of course, has lots of personal relevance for me. I grew up in the Chicago area and kind of watched the east side of the loop transform from, as you describe, a sort of weedy rail yard fronted by a few high-rise buildings that extended toward the lake into a bona fide neighborhood. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to this project and what interested you about the neighborhood?
Sure, yeah, thank you. Well, so our family had the opportunity to stay in one of the buildings at a friend's for a couple of weeks several years ago. And we fell in love with the area. You know, it's an area you see from the outside, you know, when you're strolling around Chicago. But sometimes you don't always enter it. And you might see the buildings on Randolph Street and think you have some knowledge of the area. But I think until you spend some time in there, you really don't know what's there. And I just became really interested in how this area came together. There's such a mix of old, new buildings and different architecture styles and portions that are well organized and portions that are more like a labyrinth. And I was just very curious, how did this come together? And I thought I would just find a book on the subject and read it, and that would be it. And was really surprised to not find one. And so, you know, I reached out to various people and organizations just to, you know, ask if I had missed something, and they kind of confirmed that, yeah, there's really nothing about how this area came together. There's some tangential information and books, but no organized history. And so, okay. Well, I got some work to do if I want to learn about this place. And so I started researching it, and this crazy idea kind of nagged at me. Could I write something on this? Is this something I could do? I'm not a trained historian. I haven't published a book, but those are big interests of mine. And so, you know, I thought, why not give it a shot? And I'll have to learn everything along the way, which is something I really like to do. I like to try out new things and different jobs, different projects, and just see how they go. That's kind of my joy, is the discovery of not just the material, but how do you do it? You know, this wasn't my fifth book where I know the process and it's, you know, very straightforward. It was, everything was a learning experience, which was great. And it was, you know, filled with challenges, but it's fun to see how you get beyond those and surmount them. So I was able to recruit several talented people a couple of years ago to join me in this when the crazy idea kind of took hold, and they were interested in the history and they were good researchers and editors, and they really helped me at the beginning because, you know, I didn't come from academia and I didn't know the lay of the land as far as where all the materials were. And so I had to learn that on my own. They helped me with that. Long story short, we kicked it off early in 2022, and then I was able to publish it in November of last year.
That's fantastic. So, and tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, you alluded to the fact that you're not a professional historian. Pretty much everyone that we talk to on this podcast actually has a hugely diverse background, so this is not unusual at all. But I think you might be the first person who self-published right from the start. So what is your background, and how do you see it connected to your interest in this project?
Yeah, so I grew up in Northern Illinois, and I studied engineering at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I loved that. But within 2 years of starting my engineering career, I thought that academia would be a better fit for me. And so kind of like this project, something that is not something I have experience with, I actually got into neuroscience for a while. And so it was just an interest I had is from electives I took as an engineering student. And a lot of neuroscience programs were taking people with different backgrounds. And so I reached out to a couple of universities and ended up working at Northwestern University in two research labs, one for the most part for the bulk of my time there, but started doing a little bit of work for another one. And I did that for 2 years and really loved it. But I sort of realized that what I was studying, I would likely be in academia forever. And it was just such a long road, you know, and I think I'm someone who really loves to learn something, but also likes to then move on. And so it was a great experience. But I realized after a couple years of that, that, you know, I'm probably a research and development type person, but maybe not in academia. So I went back into industry and I was in industry for the bulk of my career. So as an engineer. And then several years ago, I kind of changed course. And my wife runs a small consulting firm, and I ended up joining up with her and helping with some of the back office work. And that allowed me a flexible schedule. So some of these crazy ideas that come into my head, actually, I could work on them. And so while I was working with her, you know, I became really interested in this area that we talked about. And so that's a nice thing about, you know, kind of running your own business and having a flexible schedule is that you have some time. I mean, I've always loved to write as a hobby, but it's hard to find the time, you know, with a job and a family. And so I was able to dedicate a little time to this as a hobby to begin with. And then once we realized that it might be a real thing, then I really worked on it a lot. So just another example of, you know, enjoying diving into something new. And so, yeah, it was a 2-year project and I love it. I mean, I think writing a book is great for me because I love to dig in really deep, but I also like it to end at some point. And but not my, you know, love of Chicago history. So I'd like to continue to pursue that. And whether that's, you know, another book in another few years, I'm not sure. But
so let's get into the content a little bit. For someone who's unfamiliar or say like they've visited Chicago for the first time, what is Illinois Center? Why is it important? How does it relate to the rest of the downtown area?
Yeah, so the key thing about this area is that it probably in some ways wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the railroad. So this area that I talk about is the area north of Randolph Street to the river and east of Michigan Avenue to the lake. And so the Illinois Central Railroad actually built its tracks through the lake in the 1850s. And that's sort of a long story, but it in part helped to prevent the erosion of the lakefront. So it was something that was beneficial to lots of groups of people. So the railroad was looking for a route into the city, and a lot of the other potential routes for them were congested by other railroads. And so they said, hey, if we bring our tracks up through the lake, you know, we can build a trestle, build a breakwater, we can cut down your erosion problem. And the city really liked that idea, and then they allowed them to take over, purchase, or, you know, obtain through eminent domain the land north of Randolph Street and east of Michigan Avenue. And so that's where their station and train shed were. And they had passenger and freight service, and then they needed to expand, and they expanded by just landfilling the lake. And so they really expanded to the east, and they built big piers into the lake, and that area really grew eastward. And that's the area that I talk about. So, you know, they early to mid 1900s, there was a movement to kind of move them away from the lakefront and beautify it and use it for other purposes. And so the city kind of wanted to dedicate this area eventually to commercial and residential development. And but it's the, you know, it's the railroad that made it. So they landfilled their slips and piers and kind of moved their freight operations away from there. And then it was slow going to try to develop this area, though. You know, as this was happening, the Great Depression occurred and any development plans were put on hold. So the first chapter kind of tells that story, and it ends with the first building built in Illinois Central Railroad space, and that was the Prudential Building in the 1950s. And that was kind of groundbreaking, and I'll say airbreaking at the same time, because not only did they have to buy some land, but they actually purchased air rights. So, you know, air rights are the ability to develop above the existing land. And so the first chapter ends with the Prudential Building and how they had to do that and how complicated it was. And it really sets the stage for the rest of the book. So chapter one, 100, 150 years, chapters two through the remainder with the last 70 years and all the development that's occurred since then, starting with Outer Drive East in the early 1960s, which was a really important building at the time, largest apartment building, at least in the state. And then you asked about Illinois Center. So eventually this area became a planned development, which, you know, means that developers can't just do whatever they want in the area. And it's beyond just a zoning ordinance. It's a development where the city and developers need to agree to what happens. And that came about in the late 1960s, and development accelerated, and there were some starts and stops. And so I talk about those in kind of the bulk of the book, and it kind of closes out the last couple chapters with this newer development, Lakeshore East, which was developed by Magellan Development Group. And it's pretty remarkable what they've been able to do in 20, 25 years. You know, when you see all the starts and stops of developers and how difficult it is to stick with their plans, the fact that, you know, Magellan has been able to start it and stick with it and essentially complete it. I mean, it's almost done. Was pretty remarkable. So the last two chapters discuss Magellan's efforts in the area.
Okay, so that's that's a pretty good general sketch of the area, which is it's a complicated kind of topography because of this air rights situation, which eventually ended up covering, you know, the entire area that you describe. Maybe talk a bit about some of the civic players and the civic facilities that resulted as part of this operation. Indirectly, what we now know as Millennium Park is related to this. And then also the Maggie Daly Park, which is across the Columbus Drive from Millennium Park, is also built on some of the same infrastructure. How does that relate to the planned unit development that's north of Randolph?
Well, it is related because it was, you know, railroad land and eventually landfill. But the planned development boundaries were essentially what they were, which was north of Randolph Street and east of Michigan Avenue. And so that area south of there with, you know, what became Millennium Park, Grant Park essentially was, you know, park. It was parking lots and, you know, kind of the city's front door, and not much was done with it. And the city really desired to, you know, I guess going back to Burnham's plan from 1909, really beautify the lakefront and turn that into parkland. I think how it relates to this development is, you know, Millennium Park was, at first, people didn't know what it was going to be and were very nervous about it. And then once it was completed, it was a huge success. And it was such a big draw, not only for tourists and Chicagoans, but for development. And so I think that once that was completed in 2004, there was definitely an increase in value of property. And so that helped bring attention to this area that I talk about in the book. So there is a small portion on Millennium Park. And what's interesting about Maggie Daly is that, you know, that was developed afterwards and, you know, the mid-2010s, I guess. And the community that lived in, you know, the New East Side was very, very interested in what happened to this park that was Daly Bicentennial Plaza. And so that was east of Columbus Drive and connected to Millennium Park with the Gary Bridge. And the community that I discuss was not very interested in something just like Millennium Park being, you know, on their front door, you know, because as you get further east in this area, it's not office buildings that border the parks, it's residential buildings. And the Children's Museum was supposed to come into the area and they were, and the community was concerned about it. But through a series of events that didn't occur. And, but the community was vocal about this area and I think kind of helped, you know, maybe inform a little bit about changes in the design to make it what it is now. So I think that was kind of an interesting side story that I discovered along the way. You know, everybody can relate to Millennium Park and probably Maggie Daly as well. And to see how this community gets involved with things on their doorstep. I mean, what's interesting is it's not like other areas of Chicago or the suburbs where you've got a small park next to you and it's kind of yours. I mean, anybody can use it. It's public, but this is the lakefront. This is downtown. What do you do with this space? You know, it's, who is it for? Is it for everybody or is it for a community? Or how do you come up with a solution for these parks that serves everybody's needs? So, but ultimately what's great about this area is there's a wonderful park that steps away from the parks we just talked about, and that's the park at Lakeshore East. And so that's something that Magellan put together very soon when they developed Lakeshore East as a big draw to potential buyers and renters in the area. And so I think this area is very fortunate to have such a great park system. You know, you can go up, out your back door, let's say, to Lakeshore East Park and experience that. It's more of a neighborhood park. It's 6 acres. Or you can head south to Millennium Park and Maggie Daly and you have those very, you know, large venues. And I think it's something that's great about this particular community.
And so underneath all of this are three levels of streets. This is one of the more interesting aspects of Lakeshore East and Illinois Center, which has become less and less obvious, of course, as it's become developed. In its sort of middle age, let's say, you could observe sections of roadway that were exposed as a three-level deck over what was slowly turning from a rail yard into a variety of things, the auto pound, other sorts of uses that I think kind of concord with this idea of we have to put, you know, the more industrial and the sort of smellier and heavy use things further underground. That was originally part of the vision for the whole city when Burnham was looking at his 1909 plan. It was really only ever enacted under Wacker Drive, which is, of course, famous for being a two-level street. And the scene of many movies, et cetera, drag racing to this day, both in movies and in reality. But, you know, now it's sort of filling in and there is a few odd gaps in it where you can still walk by an empty lot. And then you realize as you're walking past this empty lot, it's like 40 feet deep and it's just down to this weedy space. Can you talk a little bit about the three level aspect of it and how that affects the ability to develop or not develop certain lots?
Well, I think that, you know, this concept of air rights comes back in. So you had these railroad tracks running up into the area, and you need to build above that, and you need to service those buildings. And so they're kind of built on stilts in a way, you know, with the Prudential Building and then Outer Drive East and some buildings after that. And it's interesting to look back at some of those old photos and see these buildings sitting there and railroad tracks traveling under them and around them and all over the place. And so that was part of, you know, the necessity of multiple levels of streets. And that's another thing that was really interesting to me. You know, why is that the case? How easy is that to navigate? I would argue that it's not very easy for a new person. that to me is neat from an intellectual standpoint. You know, how do you navigate this area and how do you build there? And it's kind of come around, you know, in the last 20 years too. You've got these existing residential buildings and then Lakeshore East going in. Where do you build a park? You know, and what level is it at? So there's three levels of streets in most of the area. So do you build it, you know, at street level at Randolph or Wacker on the upper levels, or where does it go? And so I think they had a great solution. And that was to, you know, build it kind of at the base level and then kind of ramp it up. And many people that I guess are new to the area may not know that what Lakeshore East is built on was a golf course. So to your point about how do you develop an area with, you know, different levels and some weedy old rail yards, at various points in history, there wasn't sufficient demand to develop there. And so the city and developers had to get really creative about what do we do with this space. And so then this golf course idea came about, and you know, they probably looked at multiple options and said, all right, this is our best one. Let's go with it. And so they ended up, you know, hiring a company to create that. And a lot of people love that, you know, people that have been there for a while. I mean, it's such a big draw. But I think, you know, people know that that was temporary, right? We're probably not going to keep a 9-hole golf course in arguably the prime real estate of the city of Chicago. So, but you know, when Lakeshore East came along, as I said, they built their, park at ground level and kind of sloped it up as you go further south, and some really nice ways to get there, whether it's stairs or sloping sidewalks or elevators. There's a lot of different ways of getting down to that level to visit that park from the upper levels. So yeah, it's kind of a labyrinth. I mean, that portion east of Columbus is very well organized considering what they had to work around, while the area west of Columbus was maybe criticized a little bit more because of how it came together. But yeah, definitely a fascinating thing there. This different buildings at different times, multiple levels of streets, and just a lot to deal with in this area. As a brief aside, I volunteered for a short period of time at the Art Institute as a guest guide. And so my whole job was to tell people how to get from one part of the Art Institute to another, which if you're not used to it, is not easy. You know, you've got the great main building from 1893 or whatever that is a normal building and you could probably navigate it. But then in some ways, there's a similarity to the Art Institute development. You know, they were looking for space. They ended up having to jump over the railroad tracks and build east of the railroad, the same railroad tracks we're talking about, and build east of there. And if you just look at the overhead view of the Art Institute, most people probably wonder, why is it the way it is? And so the reason I mentioned that is because I really liked being there and doing that, because that's another thing I like about the Art Institute, is that it's in some ways a labyrinth itself. And so I feel like it needs explanation. If it was some simple grand building that was not added on to, then it doesn't take some of that inquiry, I guess. And that's what drew me to what became Illinois Center, the New East Side, and the development of Lakeshore East was, this is interesting. You know, they probably didn't do all this at once with a single plan. You know, it probably came together over time. And how did this happen? So that's why I feel like it was something that needed to be told. Obviously, if you've lived there for decades and you kind of know what happened, at least lately, but I felt like, you know, people really should know what happened there, and also know, where do these names come from? You know, what do you call this place? It's still not, I would argue, it's still not simple to come up with a single name. So that's a bit of an aside, but it's a complicated area. It's various horizontal and vertical divisions that I think need some explanation.
Yeah, I think the architectural term that people tend to use is legibility. I think the legibility of Illinois Center plus Lakeshore East varies, right? I mean, as you say, the park at Lakeshore East has actually won a number of awards from landscape architecture organizations and the like. It's considered kind of a triumph of neighborhood development. But then you also have you still have these hard edges and these spindly trestles that kind of end. There's, I wouldn't call Lakeshore East and Illinois Center a sterile combination, in the sense that there's still edges that look like they could cause tetanus. You know what I mean? Like, oh, don't go in there, you know? And if you tried to navigate the pedway and you were not familiar with Chicago, and I mean intimately familiar, it's a little bit terrifying. Like, you can get stuck. You can get stuck behind. And that's true for the entire pedway, not just the part that's in east of Michigan Avenue. But, you know, there's one part that has you, if you actually wanted to go, you know, out of the weather and proceed from the corner of, you know, Michigan and Monroe, you can walk through the parking garage, walk through Millennium Station. But you have to go down on the train platform and up again in order to get back into the conditioned headway system and continue your trek over to the Hyatt Regency and the Swiss Hotel and all that. I mean, there's this feeling of accomplishment that comes from that. But is that good? I don't know if that's good urban planning to make it feel like this is urban spelunking. You know, I'm an adventurer. I feel like I have to have a miner's hat and a lamp. So, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of work that still needs to be done there. Are you aware of any efforts to try to improve the wayfinding both on ground and underground?
That's a great question. no, there could be. But, you know, my personal experience is the same. I think it is an adventure, and you might have, you know, there's some nice maps, you know, you can refer to, but it doesn't always, you know, it may not always be that useful once you get down there. And there's some signs in various locations, but that's not consistent. So yeah, you're right. I mean, definitely, if there was a more organized approach, I'm sure everybody wants it. It's just a matter of making it happen and who does it and when and for how much money. But that was, you know, kind of an issue too with even Lakeshore East, you know, once you get in there, well organized, I would say, considering, like I said, what they had to deal with. But you put a nice restaurant in there, and the people that live there, they're probably going to go and they're going to enjoy it. But what about everybody else, you know? And, you know, I talk just very briefly about a restaurant not making it, primarily just because people didn't know it was there. And, you know, signage came too late. And yeah, I think that's something that definitely does need work. And it's hard because you feel like, you know, you want a place to be well designed and well thought out. But you also want it to be interesting. And so that's why I really like these places that are confusing. You know, because to your point, it feels like an accomplishment. I mean, a good portion of the reason I wrote this book is so I could figure out what happened and then share it with other people. So, but you appreciate good design too. And when you can go into an area or a building and it's just well laid out and easy to navigate. So it's fun within a city to have maybe both of those, so that you feel like there's interesting things you can discover and then other places that are well organized for you. And though these places will last for a very long time, you know, these aren't temporary buildings. They can help, you know, cities and urban planners and developers figure out, okay, this is what we did here. How do we need to modify things going forward to make this better organized?
And also, you know, it's interesting because it doesn't, there are a few buildings within the complex, mostly it's the office buildings that are notable for their architecture, with the notable exception to that being the Aqua Tower by Studio Gang, which is a mixed-use hotel residential building. But a lot of the residential buildings that have been built there, I'm sure they're quite expensive and they're in a desirable location, but they've come in for some criticism from an architectural standpoint. I know I've interviewed Blair Kamen from the Chicago Tribune, who is, I think he described the, I have to go back and look this up. I think he described the Loewenberg style of building as like a tofu building, where it's kind of got like a sort of a mass at the bottom that contains the parking, and then it's just kind of throw some floors on top of it and the concrete. And Loewenberg's very, like, you know, bald-faced about it, saying, like, look, this is what it needs to be. This fits the program. People rent the apartments. They buy the apartments. Like, what do you want from me? what are your feelings about the overall architectural impact of this very prominent location?
No, you're exactly right. And that's something that, you know, is difficult to figure out how to manage. You can't mandate design. You have to let architects and developers do their thing. And I think, as you said, his focus was on building places that people like to live in. And he did that very well. I think his buildings sold well. And once you get inside, it doesn't matter as much what it looks like, but it's nice to, from inside, you know, one of those buildings, to see some of the other nicer buildings. But I, you know, he knew what he was doing. And I think when it came time to developing this community, he knew that you needed diversity of building designs, different styles. And so, you know, he started with a building that he allowed himself a little bit more creative freedom to do, and was maybe, you know, more interesting for critics. I don't know. Maybe didn't quite meet their threshold, but I think that they understand that as this area came together, it was successful in that he was able to bring in other architects that created signature buildings. And he talks about, you know, his world travels and seeing some places that were really well designed, but they all looked the same. So each individual building might, you know, be well designed and nice to look at. But if they're all like that, kind of going back to what we said about things being interesting and different, it may not be the, it may seem more sterile. And so with Lakeshore East, they were able to obviously bring in Jeanne Gang, as everyone knows, for two buildings. And both of those are spectacular. And not just those buildings, there are other, great buildings there too. And I mean, for me, not being an architect, obviously I can appreciate good design, but from a, if I'm looking at it from like an intellectual perspective, I like to see beyond that because whether you like it or not, they're there. And I think they can all teach you something about design and maybe what's good and what you would like to improve upon. And I love the fact that they're so different. I mean, if you look at Outer Drive East from the 1960s, at the T-shaped building and this very interesting pool next to it. And then, like you said, along the way, some more kind of simple buildings came in, modern, but with some ornament. And then you have Lakeshore East with a lot of contemporary architecture, and I think it's great. I think that mix is great. And I understand if you are an architect and you're a critic, how, you make your opinions known, and that's fair, and we all need to learn from that, and that's good information. But there's also going back to business and profitability, right? There's certain, I think Aqua was great because they were able to create such a great building without spending a lot more money. What an achievement that is, that kind of meets everybody's needs. So
So to wrap up, what do you think can or should happen next at Lakeshore East and Illinois Center to kind of complete the scene, if it, as it were? There's only a few development plots left, so that there aren't that many shots left to call. What do you think is going to happen on some of the lots that are still empty?
So, there's plans and renderings for there's two spots in Lakeshore East for high rises. And one is between Aqua and Blue Cross Blue Shield. And then the other is, and that's a thin lot, which they repurposed during the pandemic as sort of an outdoor restaurant, which was very creative. But that's where a building would go. And then the northeastern portion is set up basically for a very tall building, probably not taller than St. Regis, but another tall residential building. And so I would guess we would see both of those come to fruition. There's definitely renderings that you can see online if you want to look at what they might look like. And the one on Columbus, south of Aqua, would be mixed use, probably with hotels and apartments and condominiums. And it was originally designed to be bigger, but then the pandemic hit and they reduced that in scale. I'd love to know where those are at, and as far as the development plans and when they hope to move forward, but obviously that's private information. But there's definitely plans and you can see those online. But then there's the, I haven't looked recently at the empty lot on Stetson, I believe, east of the Michigan Plaza office buildings, which were Boulevard Towers north and south, and there was always supposed to be Boulevard Towers east. And wow, that's really sat vacant for 40 years. So that's very interesting. And I know that there have been plans along the way. At one point, it was supposed to be a Mandarin Oriental Hotel, and that didn't happen. So I'm very curious, but I haven't looked at any plans. Things change so fast. I haven't looked at that one in the last at least several months. So that'll be interesting to see. But yeah, to your point, there's just a few spots left to develop, so it's almost done.
So, Craig, thank you so much for joining us today. That was a really fun tour of Lakeshore East and Illinois Center, the neighborhood that grows on the neighborhood that is growing onto as an appendage to the east side of the loop. Always a difficult area to work in. What seems like it should have been the easiest place in the city to put a building until you realize the whole history of it. So, thank you for writing the book that you wanted to see in the world.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.